little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, here with the other host of Thinking Clearly, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
Well, I'm very excited about a conversation that we're about to have on this episode of Thinking Clearly. And our guest is a co-author of a recently released book. And as a bit of a teaser, here are a few of my favorite lines from the book. The first quote goes like this: "The critical tools of science can help us navigate and make decisions around these complicated issues. You don't have to be a rocket scientist or a scientist at all to understand what science has to offer." Another quote goes: "One of the book's repeated themes is that we can learn from our experience in the science world, which also shows the failure modes in rational thinking, and carry the lessons over to the rest of our everyday life." And the last is my favorite: "We may be the very first generations in human history that could reasonably aim to build a lasting world in which every person can thrive."
In this episode, we'll learn how the UC Berkeley course Sense and Sensibility in Science led to the release of a recent book. And we'll discuss a variety of other topics, including how to avoid failure modes when making decisions, using practices, tools, and metaphors of science to make better decisions in our everyday lives, the value of probabilistic thinking, how to weave facts and values together, and how to reboot trust and develop a new collaborative approach to our problems and opportunities.
And our guest for this episode, Robert McCoon, is a social psychologist and public policy analyst, and currently a professor of law at Stanford University. And prior to taking that post in 2014, Professor McCoon was a faculty member of both the Law School and the Goldman School of Public Policy there at UC Berkeley. And his academic credits include a BA and an MA degree in psychology, a PhD in psychology from Michigan State University, and subsequent postdoctoral work at Northwestern University. And working at the nexus between law and psychology, Professor McCoon has a long list of publications and a wide variety of topics, earning him multiple awards, including the 2019 an award from the Association of Psychological Science for a lifetime of outstanding contributions to applied psychological research. Well, he's co-authored a book in 2001 titled Drug War Heresies, which The Nation magazine called an enormously important book, likely to become indispensable. And what we brought him here to Thinking Clearly for is his involvement in co-teaching the innovative UC Berkeley course called Sense and Sensibility and Science, and his recently published book, Third Millennium Thinking, Creating Sense in a World of Nonsense, which he co-authored with physicist Saul Perlmutter and philosopher John Campbell. Professor McCoon, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Oh, I'm delighted to be here. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us. We'll dig into your book, Third Millennium Thinking, in a bit, but just to kind of start, maybe we could talk about the link between your training as a social psychologist and your interest in the applications of psychology to law, something we haven't really explored here before, I'm thinking clearly that I can remember. Based on your history, it kind of looks like that connection was made pretty early. PhD dissertation was titled Modeling the Impact of Extralegal Bias and Defined Standards of Proof on the Decisions of Mock Juries and Jurors. What sparked that early interest in applying training in psychology to the legal realm?
With so much in my career, it was really a happy accident. I kind of drifted into graduate school without a clear plan of what I was trying to do, or I wasn't even sure I wanted to go to graduate school, and ended up receiving a research assistantship position with an assistant professor who was very energetic, Dr. Norb Kerr. And he was studying jury decision making, which is not something I had thought a whole lot about. So I started working on this with him, and I immediately became enthralled by the topic for a number of reasons. First of all, psychologically, it's quite interesting in quite a number of ways. One is the fact that people are being called upon to make really high stakes consequences with potentially grave errors involved. And they're asked to do so on the basis of evidence that's highly imperfect. And they're asked to put aside their prejudice in doing so. Moreover, it's not just individuals that do this, but it's groups. And I like that social aspect. So that's how I came to do a dissertation on this. And it's interesting because I find now, near the end of my career, I'm coming kind of full circle back to a lot of the issues that I addressed in my dissertation and a lot of my recent work. I'm going back to looking at this question of how do people decide standards of proof? How do you decide you have enough evidence to actually do something? It's been a fun ride, and it's allowed me to operate at the intersection of two disciplines, which I'm always attracted to. So I'm the only psychologist at the law school. I don't have a JD. I've just written a book with a physicist and a philosopher. My last book was written with an economist. I'm always drawn to these interdisciplinary questions.
I love that idea of interdisciplinary collaboration. And I also love it that for some graduate students, the dissertation just becomes something they have to do, a milestone, something that they need to complete. For others, it becomes their life work. And it's great that you got this idea of going back to your dissertation. It means that you must have had some sort of intuitive idea that that was something that was going to be a lifelong interest. Also, looking at your CV, I noticed that early in your career, you became interested in evidence-based policy issues. For example, you testified on drug policy and problems at a California Legislative Budget Committee back in 1990. So talk a bit about your interest in and your work with evidence-based policymaking.
Yeah, sometimes it can seem like a contradiction in terms to even use that phrase. But throughout my career, I was drawn to public policy questions. I didn't just want to do basic abstract academic research. And so working on jury decision-making, tort litigation, the question of whether to legalize drugs is a topic I approached empirically for many years. The question of allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly in the U.S. military, which I worked on for about a decade. These are hot button issues. And I really took quite seriously that my role was to try as far as I could to be an honest broker and not tell people what to do, but tell people what the evidence showed so that they could make evidence-based policy decisions. And along the way, I learned a lot about the politics of research and all the biases that creep in, including my own biases, some of which I talk about in the book, and the challenges of trying to bring systematic evidence gathering like science into a political process. It's a very messy business.
I've thought about that too. I think it's a crucial issue, evidence-based policymaking. And I understand how problematic that can be because, first of all, it's labor-intensive to gather that evidence using scientific methodologies, let alone convincing policymakers to actually draft measures that have been shown to be effective, but also because of the social implications, the politicization of policies that we're highly in the midst of in this country, in the world, really. But that's a whole other episode in itself. So maybe, no pressure here, but maybe we can have you back for another entire episode for an hour just to talk about that very important issue.
Be happy to. Sure.
Well, that's great. We did get into that a little bit with Dr. Stephen Novella on one of our earlier episodes. He's a neurologist from Yale University and a well-known skeptic. He does the podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and he's also the founder of Science-Based Medicine. So we did get into that a little bit, but we just touched on it, and I'd love an entire episode on that.
Well, I'm going to try and weave a couple things here together. On a previous episode of Thinking Clearly, episode 81, for those who want to check it out in the archive, we spoke with Emlyn Metz about the process of thinking called actively open-minded thinking. Emlyn at that time was a public education specialist at the Lawrence Hall of Science at UC Berkeley, my alma mater. And we talked about the Berkeley course Sense and Sensibility in Science. The jacket of your book indicates that the book Third Millennium Thinking is based on that course. So could you tell us a little bit about that course and how it led to the publishing of your recent book.
Sure. And first, I should say how delighted I am that you spoke with Emlyn, who's a delightful person and a really talented person. When we spoke about the book at Cal Day, at a big Cal Day event, we asked her to interview us about the books, which was really fun. For me personally, the book has its origins over a decade ago, maybe 14 years ago now, something like that. A phone message when I'm on the faculty at UC Berkeley, when I was still at Berkeley, phone message. This is Saul Perlmutter calling. And, could you please call me back? I recognize the name immediately because he was one of the people who gets a free parking spot on campus for receiving a Nobel Prize in physics. I couldn't imagine why he was calling me a social psychologist. And then I thought, oh, I know. It's probably committee work. It's probably some university committee. So I called him up and we made an appointment. To my surprise, he came to see me, which is very characteristic of Saul's humility, which I think we'll come back to talking about humility. Saul did not want to ask me to be on a committee. He said, Berkeley has this big ideas initiative to create interdisciplinary courses, and I want to create one. I think it's going to be about, the role of science in a democracy. And I've been talking with a philosopher, John Campbell, and a lot of people have told me I should try to include a social science perspective. And your name keeps coming up. And I had written a piece called Biases and the Interpretation and Use of Research Results. And I think he had read that. So I said, oh, this really sounds like fun. So we spent a lot of time developing the course, probably more time than I've ever spent developing a course, in part because it's an intensely interactive course, lots of interactive exercises, so people in real time can try to experience some of the things we're talking about. And now I betrayed your alma mater and was seduced to the dark side of the bay in 2014. So I'm no longer teaching in Sensibility and Science, and they've had a whole series of other people participate in teaching the class, other psychologists and political scientists and other social scientists. But, we decided, having put all this work into organizing the course, people were saying, you should turn all this into a book. And so, to my delight, John and Saul contacted me and said, we're thinking about writing a book about this, and we think you should be part of it. And so that's where the book came about.
My summary of this book is that it pulls from lessons derived from the culture of science, describes tools from the science toolbox, and shows how these can be used to make better decisions in everyday life. Is that a good summary?
I think it's not an easy book to summarize. There's some traditional book categories that it kind of bears a family resemblance to. So one of them is critical thinking books. So there's a whole genre of critical thinking books. And our book shares a lot in common with those, especially the first half of our book. There's also a book I will call Celebrations of Science, or even more, the more extreme versions are Shut Up and Listen to the Scientists. And our book can kind of resemble those. It also can resemble these books on information overload and how to deal with a deluge of information. And I think our publisher kind of spun it that way on the back cover. What makes the book hard to summarize, there are a couple of things. One is, while we are talking about tools of science, we're not talking about the methodologies of science, the theories of science per se. We're really talking about the craft of thinking through problems collectively that scientists use. And that's not something that's necessarily taught in any course in science. We present relatively few findings of science in the book, but we talk a lot about this toolbox. It's really two sets of tools. We talk about habits of mind, and the habits of mind comes closest to books on better decision making or critical thinking, just the ways we can fool ourselves and how to avoid those mental traps. But there's also this second half of the book is about these habits of community, and one of the things we really want to get across is it's not enough just to have good habits of mind. If you need to get things done in a community, you need to work with other people. And in fact, other people are really important in helping you make your own mind work better. They will keep you honest and challenge you. And it's very easy for brilliant scientists to go off the rails because they're not being kept on track by skeptical colleagues who challenge them. And that's really important in a democracy where we need to work together to get things done. So I think the habits of community, for me, is as important a part of the book as the habits of mind, and something I hope, you know, we can get across in the book.
Yeah, I agree. The book does have mass appeal and could be used as an outright critical thinking book, in that it covers the highlights of that. In this episode, in our time that we have here, we're not going to be able to get into all those tools in the science toolbox. But let's start out with sort of the big picture and talk about the raft and the pyramid metaphors that are used to depict the structure of science as you describe them in your book.
Yeah, so metaphoric thinking is very powerful for both good and bad. You know, a good metaphor can help you really encapsulate something that is otherwise hard to think about, but a metaphor can also powerfully kind of lead you astray. So part of the book where we talk about these two metaphors, the raft and the pyramid, we're really trying to talk about the importance of people understanding science as a fallible, iterative process. A process in which mistakes are made, in which you sometimes have to take a few steps back and change things you're doing. And so the raft metaphor, the image here is a small group of people floating down a river in a raft. And the raft is a bunch of logs that are lashed together. And sometimes one of those logs will fail. And so they bring extra logs, and they have to remove one of the logs while they're in the river, floating down the river, remove a log, strap in another one. And so they're kind of repairing the raft as they go. They can't, you know, they can't wait till they have the perfect raft. There is no perfect raft. They have to repair as they go. That, we think, it's not a perfect metaphor for science, but it captures something important about science, which is that science makes revisions all the time as it changes its understanding of things. And that's not catastrophic. You get on the raft knowing that some of the logs are going to fail and anticipating that. That's just part of the process. It doesn't mean that it's a flawed process. It just means, like any real life process, you just need to plan ahead and deal with it. And so science does that all the time. And that conflicts with another metaphor that I think a lot of people have of science. It's, science is this pyramid, this solid edifice in which there's an absolute rock solid foundation, and everything is piled on top of that rock solid foundation. I mean, that metaphor can convey science as something extremely stable and powerful, but it also can raise alarms that, well, what if there's something wrong at the foundation? Then the whole pyramid is going to collapse, right? Which is not what happens in science. We find problems with our foundation all the time. And so the raft metaphor doesn't convey the strength and power and this towering edifice of the pyramid. It's a much messier process. I think it comes a little closer to what science is really like. Now, the reality is, even the raft metaphor is just a metaphor, and it kind of exaggerates how flimsy science is. And in fact, you know, this is a really big, pretty solid raft. You know, the most of our logs don't go bad very often. So, you know, metaphors are imperfect, but science is not perfect either. So that's kind of what we're trying to convey.
Well, I think it's a powerful metaphor to rebut the criticism that, well, science is changing all the time. And first they said this thing, and now it's another thing. And so why should I believe in science at all? So it counters that. It gives a good idea. I like that metaphor. And it's been vetted by a philosopher, right? You can look up a paper by Ernest Sosa from Brown and Rutgers University, who wrote a paper on that. So if you want to know more about that, listeners, you can actually dig that out of the internet.
It does remind me that my car has a spare tire in the back, and I don't look at that and say, well, I guess I can't rely on my car to get somewhere.
Yeah, boy, a car is a failed experiment,
right? Yeah,
because you need a spare tire. Nobody says that.
Good analogy. Well, I want to remind listeners that we are talking to social psychologist and public policy analyst, Professor Robert McCune from Stanford University, about a variety of topics related to his recently published book, Third Millennium thinking, creating sense in a world of nonsense.
Yeah, well, returning back to that book, in the first chapter of Third Millennium Thinking is called Decisions, Decisions, Decisions. And you cite three ingredients that need to be kept in balance when making good decisions. Could you help us understand what are those ingredients and how do we get the balance right to avoid what you call failure mode?
This comes up in the first chapter, but it's really a running theme throughout the book. We're not just focusing on looking for science to answer questions. We're talking about having to make decisions in the world. And when you need to make decisions in the world, as opposed to just wanting to be informed about the world, so you want the most accurate information possible. And, you know, experts serve the role of accumulating the tools, both mental tools and physical tools, to try to collect the most accurate information. And that's a vital part of making good decisions. But that's only one ingredient. It's not the whole recipe. And you also need values. When you're going to act, actually make decisions, you have to consider not just the facts, but your values. There's no getting around it. And that's partly because the factual information is not going to be perfect. You are going to make errors sometimes, and you have to think about the trade-offs between what are called false positive errors, thinking something is true when it turns out it wasn't true after all, and acting on that, versus deciding it's not true and failing to act when maybe you should have acted, which would be a false negative error. So you have to consider values. So you need the facts from the experts. You need to consider values. But you also need some sort of way of integrating the two, some sort of procedure. Now there are two levels at which this can happen. There's the easy one and the hard one. And the easy one itself is really, really hard. And so the easy one is when you're just making decisions for yourself and nobody else is involved. And as we all know, that can be excruciatingly hard sometimes. So then you personally need to decide what are your values, what are your facts, and how are you going to combine them? And that's a challenge. And that's partly what the book is about. But the book is also about collective problem solving, where we need to make collective decisions about interventions in the world. What should we intervene in a particular way to try to mitigate climate change or to respond to a pandemic or whatever the collective issue is we're facing? And there the procedures get really complicated because you have to take into account other people's values as well and try to respect other people's values. So you need this balance of these three ingredients, and it's a tricky balance to achieve.
And we're going to get into that in the next few questions here, because the last three chapters of your book are what I call where the rubber meets the road, and they exude optimism, which I consider to be a combination of hope and confidence. Those last three chapters were the most motivating part of the book, and that's great that you saved that motivation for the last. We talk a lot about critical thinking, and we promote the idea of critical thinking, but why do it? It's a lot of work. It's a lot easier just to memorize some talking points from our group and give those and let it go and do the rest of the things in our lives rather than really try to figure out what the truth is and what the best path forward is. So I love those last three chapters, and they provide ideas for the path forward for us all in order to thrive and meet collective challenges. So let's move to those last chapters, and then as time permits, we're going to dig into a multitude of other ideas discussed in the book. But the last three chapters, one deals with weaving together facts and values, which you just talked a little bit about. Another one talks about how we deliberate together, which you talked a little bit about. We live in a pluralistic society, and that can be difficult. And the final chapter is how to reboot trust. So we're going to give a little bit of focus on those. We're going to take the one on facts and values and rebooting trust. We're going to pass at this point on deliberating together, because we've talked a lot about that on thinking clearly. We use the phrase having more effective dialogues. So let's focus on facts and values and get into that a little more deep. Critical thinking skills help us identify the facts of an issue. But how and when do we explore differences in feelings and values and bring that into our conversations or our thinking? And how do we weave those together? Weave together facts and values. And maybe you could start by just giving a little bit more detail on the difference between something that is a fact and something that is a value.
Sure. So, you know, the distinction between facts and values kind of took a beating in the 20th century academy with people saying there's no such thing as a value-free fact, which led to, you know, a lot of cynicism about the notion of a fact, which led to people, you know, putting fact in scare quotes every time they use the word fact. I think you see this in universities as a kind of a clash between the humanities departments and the science departments. And, you know, frankly, I worry that our book will be seen as like a kind of eat your vegetables book, where we're telling people you have to learn all these hard concepts of science and your current ways of approaching things are not good enough. So I'm glad you mentioned that there is dessert at the end of the meal in the latter part of the book, that there's some more uplifting things. But the thing about values is it is possible to think systematically about values in the same way that we think systematically about facts. We turn our brain off when we talk about values and we just think as if it's just raw emotion, just expression of feeling. And, you know, I express feelings all the time and I can enjoy the expression of feelings. But really, when you start to think about values, so take a value like the importance of equality in society or the importance of freedom in society. Those are not factual questions. It's not that we're going to go out and measure. There are ways to measure equality in society, but it's what's really at issue there is how much weight should we put on equality? Okay, maybe we know how to measure it, but how much weight should we give that in our decision making? So valuing is very much about emphasis. How do we rank order the things we care about? And you can think systematically about values because, in fact, none of us hold just one single value. All of us have a whole bunch of values. I've never met anyone who didn't care about freedom at all. I've never met anyone who didn't care about equality at all. Everyone I know cares about both of those things. People I know differ a lot in how they would rank those two things. You know, so we put different weights on these things, but that doesn't mean we have nothing in common with someone else who's from the other side of the spectrum. And that suggests that there are inevitably going to be value trade-offs. Anytime we have to make real-life decisions, we're trying to find some way to compromise between freedom and equality, the value of honesty, the value of beauty. And it's very hard to maximize all of those at once. So inevitably, there are going to be some trade-offs involved. Everybody's going to have to sacrifice some of the things they care about if we want to get things done. And so we try in the book to say that, first of all, it's a terrible mistake to ignore values and just think that science can solve all these problems for us. And usually when you do that, all you're really doing is you're hiding the values. Okay, so scientists who weigh in on an issue and they don't grapple with the value trade-offs involved, all they're doing is they're really hiding their own values. You know, they're importing their own values into their pronouncements, which I think is an abuse of authority. We need to consult people on their values. People need to be able to affirm their values. In fact, my colleague at Stanford, Claude Steele, has this wonderful research on what he calls value affirmation. What he shows that when two people of conflicting views are going to interact, in a control group, he just has them interact, and it usually goes badly, but in a treatment condition, he has them affirm their personal values first. And there's something about the exercise of stating your commitment. These are the things I care about. And also hearing someone else do it, that just is really powerful in helping people to find common ground and to reach solutions. There's a lot that can be done to more constructively grapple with values in our society, not just facts.
Here on Thinking Clearly, a topic that's come up a number of times is trust. We've had a number of shows for folks who want to look them up, number 70, 71, and 72. Bring us to that last chapter titled Rebooting Trust for a New Millennium to life for us. How do we begin to rebuild trust, and how does game theory shed some light on this question?
Sure. So we needed to do two things to bring the book to a close. It was a challenging recipe because we needed we wanted to bring the book to a close on an uplifting note of that we can collectively do better, and there are reasons to be optimistic that we can, in fact, get better and better at this. But at the same time, we had to deal with this grappling, nagging voice in the back of our heads throughout the whole book process, which was, isn't everything you're writing about completely naive? And so why might the book be naive? The book can seem naive. Any book like this can seem naive because it seems to suggest that all you have to do is learn these techniques, apply them faithfully, and problems are solved. But you can't even get to that point if people aren't willing to act in good faith, okay? And so this is where the trust issue comes in, is when you have to interact with other people, both experts and non-experts, there's some element of trust that's required. So what do I mean by good faith? From our perspective, is arguing in good faith when they actually want to know, eventually, they actually want to find the best solution, where they actually want to know what the truth is. And that entails the notion that they're willing to change their mind. And the reality is, in our society, a lot of what passes as debate is not actually really debate at all. It's not about persuasion at all. It's simply about people expressing their commitments to their values and basically bullying people who disagree with them. And this, I'm not singling out one side or the other. I think this happens on the left. I think this happens on the right. And I think it's important for us to all be honest about ourselves when we engage in dialogue. Are we just pretending to engage in persuasion when really what we're engaged in is name calling in the hope of coercion, of just getting our way? I mean, we need to be honest with ourselves that that's really what's going on. Okay, so here's where game theory comes in. So if you're a reader of our book, anybody who made it that far in our book is probably aspiring to do better, probably cares about trying to find the truth, find better solutions. I think the people who we're calling bad faith actors are unlikely to read our book in the first place. If they do, they won't make it to the last chapter. Okay, so you want things to go better. What do you do in a world of bad faith actors? And so here we took some lessons from game theory research on the evolution of cooperation. I won't do a deep dive into this. We'll just do the thumbnail sketch. But we're focusing here heavily on ideas of Robert Axelrod, who set up these computer tournaments where people could submit different strategies for playing prisoner's dilemma games, which is a particular game theory situation in which it's very tempting for you to behave in a selfish way, and it's even rationally self-interested for you to do that. The problem is, if the other person also acts in a rational, self-interested way, you'll both be worse off than if you had cooperated together. And so cooperating together is a huge act of trust. And Axelrod showed in his work that the way that you get to the evolution of trust, and he literally has done evolutionary experiments where these little players get to procreate, you know, every time they earn points. They don't just earn points, they earn offspring. And so he gets to see what populations will flourish. How do you get a flourishing population of cooperators? And what he shows is, if you always cooperate, you don't do very well at all, because someone who won't cooperate will exploit you. And so the answer is not to just always walk around cooperating with everyone. But what he finds is that the players who thrive are players who have two traits. They are nice and forgiving, but they are also, they're not suckers. Okay, so you're trying to be nice and forgiving, but not be a sucker. And so how do you do that? Well, the strategy is called tit for tat in a game theory situation. It means on your first move, you always cooperate. No matter, you know nothing about the person you're playing with, you cooperate with them. You assume the best of them and you cooperate. On your second move and thereafter, you reciprocate, which means you do whatever they did on the previous move. Okay, so if you cooperate and they don't cooperate, you get burned, but you only get burned once. And then the next move, you don't cooperate anymore. You don't keep beating your head against the wall. You say, okay, I'm not going to cooperate. And now the reality is this does not mean you keep trying to interact with the person and keep trying to screw the person. It really means you go find someone else who will cooperate. Okay, and that's what happens in his simulations, is the players who play this way, when they find each other, they thrive because immediately they cooperate and they get the best possible outcomes and they begin to proliferate. Interestingly, in his simulations, you never get rid of the complete non-cooperators, the exploiters. There's always going to be this residual population of about 5%. And that's because you can keep moving through the population, trying to find somebody that they haven't exploited yet that they can still exploit. So it's very hard to get rid of them. But these players that don't cooperate, they don't thrive because they don't get things done. They don't get all the possible benefits. And so the lesson we try to convey from that is you can't make everyone operate in good faith. And you can't beat your head against the wall by trying to cooperate with people who don't want to cooperate. But there are a lot of people out there who do want to cooperate. And when they find each other and they thrive, they can get things done. They can solve problems. You know, and you see this in all sorts of ways in small communities that form around problem solving. And in the second half of the book, we try to talk about a lot of the new ideas that are coming out for ways of trying to help people do that.
These chapters that we've been talking about and these issues weaving together facts and values and rebuilding trust, it's not that they're isolated. They're very connected to each other. I like to think of facts and values and trying to bring those into a conversation. So facts I think of as being descriptive. They're describing the way the world is. You know, if you're a realist in terms of you believe that there's a real world out there, human beings are trying to sample that real world and get as close as they can to what the real world is. And yes, of course, it's constrained by our abilities to conceptualize, but we do the best we can. And I think we've reached a point where we're pretty good at that, especially through science. But you can get keyed into when the values come into play because people are using words like good and bad or should and shouldn't. And so here at Thinking Clearly, our last episode, actually, we got into this, what we call the LAP or LAP EFI method of having a civil dialogue, which is to listen carefully, ask clarifying open questions, paraphrase to check for understanding, and then expressing your own views in a civil way, using critical thinking. And then you attempt to find common ground. And you mentioned that in rebuilding trust, we try to find common ground and identify areas of difference. In fact, our last episode, Julia and I did a kind of spontaneous demonstration of doing that. So thinking and trying to work in my mind on just how to bring those values and when to bring those values into play, because obviously, they're very, very important. A lot of people are mainly motivated by their values and use talking points or whatever to present those values. So how do we do this in a way that rebuilds trust is, I think, the important focus for trying to rebuild trust in our world when people have real differences of opinions about the world they'd like to live in.
Obviously, it's a huge challenge, and it sometimes feels like it's harder than it's ever been before in our society right now. Part of the problem is that the way we've split off into these ideological tribes, we show no effort to respect the values of our opponents. We mock their values. And you see this on the left and you see this on the right. And rather than saying, I hear you, you're saying you really, really care about such and such a value. You really care about preserving freedom from government interference, or you really care about security at the border, or, you know, whatever the issue is. But I care about this other issue, like, you know, the well-being of refugees who are being forced to flee another country because of human rights abuses, let's say. Okay, let's put both of those concerns on the table. How do we find solutions that try to minimize the harm to both of our values? And you know, the thing about empiricism can't resolve factual questions, but it can inform factual trade-offs. So empirically, for example, we can often find out, well, just how much will we be impinging on freedom if we use a certain intervention? Just how much will we be putting security at risk or equality at risk? And we can quantify that, and then we can start looking for solutions that operate sort of between the cracks, and solutions that maybe require some sacrifices in terms of equality, but also some sacrifices in terms of freedom or security or whatever the value is. Each side may have to give a little, but it's actually pretty rare to have stark zero-sum situations where our only option is either I completely win and you completely lose, or you completely win and I completely lose. I mean, I do think there are some examples like that, and many people see abortion that way, and that may be why it's probably our most contentious issue. But there are a great many public policy issues that are much more nuanced than that, where it's possible to find solutions at the cracks, you know, solutions that allow each side to get some of what they're hoping to get.
And this idea of it is possible kind of relates to a couple terms that you use in the book, scientific optimism and then social optimism. So is that kind of what you're talking about when you're talking about social optimism, is folks who have differences, different ideas about policy and the way the world should be, that they have a can-do kind of idea that we can find common ground and we can find a solution?
Yes. I mean, you mentioned the importance of optimism earlier, and I couldn't agree with you more. And I do think we have a particular way of thinking about optimism in the book that may be different than what a lot of people think of as about optimism. And that is, so first of all, let me talk about scientific optimism, and then I'll talk about what we call social optimism. So for us, scientific optimism is not the belief that everything's going to turn out fine, that we're going to end up in the best of all possible worlds. Scientific optimism is very specifically the belief, it's a contingent belief, it's a belief that if we try, we can find solutions, that there are solutions out there and that we're capable of finding them. Okay, so it's not a passive sort of optimism that all we have to do is sit back and wait and wonderful things are going to happen. No, that's not the world we live in. Scientific optimism is a belief that isn't really talked about very much in the scientific literature, but we think it's very characteristic of working scientists, which is working scientists tend to assume that any new problem they learn about is solvable. And so they get to work solving it. And if they had decided, oh boy, that's a really hard problem, I don't think we can solve that, they probably wouldn't have found all the solutions they found. And in fact, one of the things that's really funny about the sociology of science is when one team finds out that their competitors claim they have a solution to a problem, in the history of science, you often find that the second team independently finds the solution to the problem even before they know what their competitors found, simply by finding out that apparently there is a solution, they suddenly find it themselves. And that has happened many times in the history of science. So this kind of, you said can-do, this kind of can-do spirit doesn't just need to be unique to scientists. I think whenever we encounter difficult personal or social problems, we think it's really important to take this attitude of, this is potentially solvable. We can make progress on this. And It's important. The reason why we think it's so important is because critical thinking, and in fact, liberal arts education, is very good at training skepticism. And we think skepticism is a really important trait, not being gullible, scrutinizing claims. But the problem is, skepticism is just a brake pedal. And you can't drive a car with just a brake pedal. You need a gas pedal, too. And we think scientific optimism is the gas pedal and skepticism is the brake pedal. Now, if you think about this, this is not something we actually say in the book, but if you think about social media discourse, we often see people who are very skeptical and very pessimistic, okay? So they're skeptical, they don't believe any argument, but they also think things are going to turn out badly. And that's basically a recipe for cynicism. And cynical people, there's this weird thing about internet discourse, which is that the cynical person always seems to win. Because if you take the most cynical position, no one can ever kind of prove you wrong. And so you get the last word. And it drains all the energy from a conversation. It saps all the enthusiasm, all the gumption from the population of people in the conversation. So it's very corrosive. Now, if you take someone who is skeptical but very optimistic, you get wishful thinking and magical thinking. And we see a lot of that on the web too. You can also see another combination, which is people who are very gullible, they're not skeptical, and they're very pessimistic, and they are conspiracy thinkers. And so if you think about the 2x2 table of these combinations of skepticism versus gullibility and optimism and pessimism, we're arguing that there's a sweet spot for making progress, which is to combine skepticism with optimism. That's not a contradiction in terms. It's entirely possible to do both. And in fact, that's the way most working scientists approach the world.
Sounds like a lot of things in life. Balance is the key, finding the sweet spot and the balance of these things that are in tension. I don't want to open a can of worms, but as we're talking about these things, one of the differences in my mind is the tension between people who want a revolution and people who are willing to see change and work for change incrementally. But that's a whole other can of worms that probably Julie and I will do in an after show talk with each other. We've had that before. I do think that tension is critical in what we're experiencing now. We're getting along in time here, but can you give us just a quick run through? And we've talked about probabilistic thinking. We've had John Allen Paulos from Temple University, who wrote the book Innumeracy, one of my favorite books on,
a wonderful book,
on that subject, on a couple times and talked about it. But just give us your quick thoughts on the importance of probabilistic thinking.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you highlighted that, because I would say of our habits of mind section of the first half of the book, if I had to name one tool that I think is the most powerful tool to have in your toolbox, it is probabilistic thinking. I think of it as kind of a superpower for a couple of reasons. One is conceptually, it helps you, keeps you from making conceptual mistakes. And I'll talk about that in a second. But it also has a very wonderful effect on people's personality. Why do you want to learn about probabilistic thinking? One of the reasons why probabilistic thinking is a superpower is because it stops hurting so bad to be shown when you make a mistake. And we are all making mistakes, and we can't avoid making mistakes. And we're all terrified of how bad it would be to make a mistake. So this tool, probabilistic thinking, that turns out to really shield your ego from that fear of making mistakes. And so the tool of probabilistic thinking is to stop thinking in black and white, yes or no, dichotomous terms about issues. To think that you either have to be on one side of an issue or another is the way we organize discourse in our society. We act as if it's not possible to have a conversation unless you're either on one side or the other. You got to pick sides. This really bedeviled me in trying to speak truth to power as an expert witness and giving policy briefings for policymakers, because I'm often really pressed to they'll say, Professor McCune, please tell me what you really think. Okay, so I'll tell them about my findings, and I'll say, on the one hand, on the other hand, and here are the caveats and the boundary conditions and the limitations in our knowledge. And they'll say, no, Professor McCune, please tell me what you really think. And it's a dilemma for me, because what I wanted to say is, I just did tell you what I really think, you know. But I get what they're asking, and what they're really asking is, we want you to take a side. And this desire to just take one side or the other forecloses the reality that we're never really sure of most of the things we believe. Now, life requires us to make bets. When we take action, we have to make a bet, okay? So we commit ourselves to one side or the other. But it's entirely possible to do that in a provisional way. Saying, in fact, there's a wonderful book by Annie Duke, Thinking in Bets, the professional poker player, which is just about this point, just a wonderful book, which dovetails with ours really nicely. So probabilistic thinking tries to move away from this either-or thinking to thinking, you know, degrees of belief in a proposition. And we try to teach our students, we have these exercises where we have them converse about a topic, but we have them identify every time they assert a fact during the conversation, which itself, by the way, is a really useful exercise, to just say, you're talking to someone and just punctuate your sentence by saying fact or value. No, I don't recommend this in daily life, but it's a good exercise to make you realize the difference between the things you say that are facts and the things you say are value. And then we ask the students to take the next step and try to put degrees of confidence on their factual statements. And they quickly realize that there's almost nothing that they would put 100% or 0% on. There are a handful of things, but most things that come up in ordinary conversation are things for which their degree of belief is more like, you know, 75%, maybe 80%. Now, in the book, we show that people actually are not well trained in this, and so they're not always what's called calibrated. And calibrated refers to having an accurate sense of your confidence levels. So what does it mean to have an accurate sense? If I say I'm 50% confident in a series of assertions that I make, over time, I should be right about half the time if I'm calibrated, okay? If I say I'm 100% certain, out of all the times I say I'm 100% certain, I should be right 100% of the time. If I say I'm only 10% certain, I should be right 10% of the time. Now, there's one profession that's really good at this, and that's meteorologists. When meteorologists say there's a 60% chance of rain, it turns out, if you look at the last 1,000 times they said 60% chance of rain, it will rain almost exactly 60% of those times. What a meteorologist is doing is they're telling you very honestly, I can't tell you for sure if it's going to rain tomorrow. All I can tell you is our best approximation, it's a 60% chance of rain. So now if a pollster claims that they can predict support for a presidential candidate plus or minus 5 percentage points, and it turns out they get it wrong, we think they get it wrong because a different candidate won than the candidate we thought. You know, Donald Trump gets elected, so the pollsters made a mistake. No, the pollsters actually were within their margin of error. They didn't tell us 100%. They predicted support for Hillary Clinton, and they predicted support for Donald Trump. And they were within the margin of error. So they didn't actually make a mistake there. Well, the ones who made a mistake are the ones who went beyond their data and said Hillary Clinton is going to win, because that's not actually what their data allow them to say. All their data allow them to say is what's the percentage likelihood. And so trying to learn probabilistic thinking, it's we don't train our kids this way. We don't cultivate this ability. And it's something we really need to cultivate because it enables us to not get trapped in these silly arguments.
Good summary of that important topic. We're getting to that point where we need to wrap up. So there's so much more to talk about, but because we are out of time, I guess the listeners will just have to get the book, Third Millennium Thinking, which I highly recommend to learn about those topics that we haven't gotten a chance to talk about and to get a little bit more depth in the ones that we have. For example, we haven't talked about orders of understanding or Fermi estimates, triangulation. We just did talk about calibration, which is really important. Hill's criteria for finding causal connections. When you can't do decisive experiments, use Hill's criteria, and many other topics that are useful for critical thinking. So, Rob McCoon, thank you so much for all your work on that book and all your other work to help folks improve their decision-making and helping them to understand how to find common ground to implement more effective policies that guide us to survive and thrive. And I'm going to use a little quote from your book, as a global human family. Love that. And so on our Facebook page, we're going to post a link to your Stanford faculty webpage, your Wikipedia page, and your books. Are there any other links that you'd like us to post?
I'm not going to boost any particular links, but this has been a wonderful conversation. And I know some of the other guests you've interviewed, I could recommend any of their links because you've interviewed some people who are doing wonderful things that I think are very much in harmony with what we tried to do in the book.
I like to think of us as that community.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I'd love us all to get together in some way and make a positive impact on starting that community of social optimism. So a big thank you also to our listeners for your interest and support. And as always, thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Bob.
And until next time, keep thinking.
Clearly.